Good. Good morning. So we're starting with the bulge today, and the title is as you see. There's the overall dynamics of a bar, and then there's some new results that have come out recently based on Virac and Gaia, which I think are going to make a significant further impact, and only some of which we know at the moment. So because it's the first talk, I thought I'd spend a few words on the goals. So for all these surveys and for Gaia, the goals are to understand Milky Way structure and evolution, and more generally, hopefully, also the evolution of these galaxies in a wider sense. And the way I think this might work is by understanding our Milky Way in great depth and the processes that operate in great depth. We might be able to calibrate the simulation in such a way that we could actually believe what they predict in other galaxies. And in this sense, the Milky Way might give us significant insight also for the rest of galaxy formation. So these are very general things, but now what about the bulge? So it makes sense to me to discuss the bulge and the bar together, because the bulge, to the greatest part at least, is the inner three-dimensional part of the bar. And these quantities, two components, are important because together they make up about two-thirds of the stellar mass, we think. And because the bar is rather large, as you'll see, it'll also interact with the disk nearby. So some of the questions are listed here on this slide. I don't have time to discuss all of this. Mostly it'll be on the first four. About the dynamical structure, the mass of the bulge, and the bar, whether there's a small classical bulge or not. Again, I don't have much time for this. A little bit about dark matter in the bulge, and I'll concentrate perhaps on the pattern speed today, based on the new data. And also, one of the next points, this of course is going to be important for the rest of the conference, so I won't say anything to people who know more about this than I. And I also won't have time much for these points, which are by themselves very interesting, is when the bulge stars formed, and also when the bulge is a structure formed, which doesn't necessarily be the same time. And then we're beginning to learn about the chemodynamical structure of the bulge and bar, but again, I think this is a subject for the future, with much more to come. Okay, so this is the 3D structure of the bulge and bar from what we call red star clump giant star count tomography. Essentially, this is using red clump giant stars, which are sort of nearly standard candles. Therefore, you can locate them with suitable techniques, and you can reconstruct the three-dimensional density distribution simply by counting the number of stars at the various locations in the galaxy. And the result is this typical structure here. We have a bar. From the star counts, it appears to reach to about 5 kiloparsecs, at least in the very thin part, and slightly less in the more ordinary part, as you'll see. From the side, it looks like a typical box peanut bulge might look like. We've called this the dinosaur view for a while, but it's not quite correct because it depends on the pattern speed. But you can imagine that if you were able to wait another two-thirds of a 60-degree bar rotation, I think it requires, and the sun is also out of the galactic plane, it'll be a spectacular view on the sky. And we know that because we can reconstruct it from the star counts. So the shape that you see here is naturally similar to what comes out of N-body simulations. When the central part of an unstable bar buckles into a box peanut bulge, or sometimes also forms the resonant capture. And in this sense, we might say that we already understand a lot just by looking at the structure. And of course, there's been many papers on the structure of the bulge and the bar before, based on various data sets. The part that is perhaps improved with this is that we've been able to combine several large infrared surveys and been able to find the clump giant stars in the large portion of the sky. So this is all old work now. It's about 3 or 5 years old. So here's an illustration of what I just said. It's a model from Ivan Martinez Valpuesta, stands for many. It's cited at the bottom here. What you see is the formation of a thin bar, which then starts becoming unstable in this buckling instability sense. And it's after a relatively short time settling down into this peanut bulge structure. It may happen this, that the bar grows in time, and then there is another buckling event later in the course of the evolution. And in this model, for example, this happens after many giga years further evolution later than the first buckling. On the right, you, say, so you see some images from a paper by Peter Irwin and Victor De Battista, where they've been looking at simulations in a surface density sense. I've been trying to find these BP bulges in also intermediate inclination systems. And they found two where they feel, based on these trapezoidal structures, they may be candidates for an ongoing buckling instability. So it may happen in nature as well. So this is just briefly how this tomography works. Red clump stars are here in the CMD. They are very narrow in their absolute luminosity for an old population, corresponding to about 0.17 or so magnitudes in K-band. The color spread is even smaller. You find them in this typical luminosity function in upper bulge field. This is the exponential giant branch here, and on top you find the red clump stars, and they essentially have this shape because mostly their line of sight distribution in the upper bulge, also a little bit of because their population spread depends on the age and metallicities. And then as you go down into the plane, there'll be another spread induced by the differential dust extinction within each of the fields that you look at. And then subtracting the giant branch, you can then deconvolve this distribution here to get you the spatial distribution on the line of sight. If you do this for many lines of sight, you can then reconstruct the entire density distribution. And so this was done in this work here, and the error estimated on the density at the time was of order 10% in most of the bulge. Okay, for the planar bar, it is more difficult because all the density profiles are exponential, and so the densities into the long bar are much lower than in the bulge, and it was no longer possible to do a deconvolution of these data. Rather, we would have to fit a model. Now, the data is indicated here and here. So this is and even there. This is okay. Let's start from the top. This is the surveys. Two masses: blue, red is VVV, and green is UKITS. And they've been combined and also matched with GLIMPS for estimations of extinctions. This is a particular map of the bulge in the brightest giants, which make you very clear that there is this asymmetry in the sky, which comes from a geometry only, so nothing fundamental, but the bulge is sort of twisted relative to us by about 25 or 30 degrees. Here you see directly using the clump giant stars how this nearby stars at around longitude about 20 or so or 30 degrees are much closer than the center. This is about 5-6 kiloparsec distance according to the scale here. On the right hand side, data are much scarcer because the bar is far away. And essentially, if one has strict quality criteria, one is losing the downturn of the red clump star luminosity function, and so the estimation of the parameters becomes uncertain, and so we didn't want to use these data for the structural work. On the bottom here, you see a set of plots, which is just a subset, which is distance along the line of sight in this direction and transverse distance in the plane in that direction. And the density of stars is given by the color plots, and so here you see the bulge in the center, and then how the bar elongates into this region. And the further down in latitude you go, the further out and the easier you can see it, because the star counts, of course, increase towards the plane. And also, as you'll see, the bar is longer in the plane than slightly further up. And so the model that was fitted was then a combination of a made-to-measure model for the bulge and a parametric model for the long bar. So I want to emphasize one point because it's perhaps going to become relevant again, that when you look at the clump giant density distributions as you go outwards in the bar from here about 15 degrees, and this is last plot is about 25, you see this very characteristic transition between what we call the thin bar. This is this structure here, this exponential, and then which is then going to be superseded and dominated by a component that is even much thinner than the thin bar. Now, the thin bar has a vertical scale length about 180 parsec. This super thin component has 45 parsec. And so I remember seeing this in the COBE data and thinking this must be interstellar medium, so let's just discard it. But it wasn't, because here, this is red clump giant stars, and so the minimum age these stars have between 1 and 2 giga-years or so, at least that's where the most number. So even if this is a relatively young population, this is stars. And you can see also how when you look at the scalar as a function of longitude, this is the X here, the nearby part of the X and the distant part of the X, you see this thin component, and then we lose it because of the exponential density profile, we lose it in the noise at around 25 degrees. But at the same time, you've got this super thin component, which sort of picks up between 15 degrees maybe, and is in the end dominating the star count at the edge of the bar. And this continuous variation was one of the arguments for thinking that actually we do have a transition between the 3D and 2D bulge, and it's all the same structure rather than two bars, it was at some point claimed earlier. So the advantage of having this super thin component is you can determine very well where the galactic plane is. And I wanted to tell you about this briefly. So this basically is based on some early work by Alisa Goodman, who was looking at the infrared dark clouds in the galactic plane and noticed that they're all at negative latitude. And the question was, why? And it's very simple. It's that when in 1959 the IU decided about the galactic plane, they didn't know about Sagittarius A star, and they didn't really know about the offset of the sun with respect to the plane of the disk. And so the galactic plane they decided is this plane here. This was sort of reaching Sagittarius A, which was believed to be the galactic center here, and so it's a couple of parsecs above Sagittarius A star. And then the distance of the sun from the plane, we now know, is something like between 15 and 25 kiloparsecs. It's not so well known, I find, given especially the recent results. But if you then ask where is your bar in the same latitude space, it's these measured points here. And then you see that essentially that if you assume that this is a linear tilt, then the bar is away from the galactic plane, the real galactic plane, by about 0.05 degree at the maximum. That's for 25 parsec solar height above the plane. And that's about 5 parsec. And these 5 parsec at the end of the bar is for a total length of 5 kiloparsec. So it means the bar is aligned with the galactic plane to 1 part in 1,000. I thought that was remarkable at that time when this first came out. And I wanted to emphasize this here because we're now making models for explaining the wiggles in the galactic plane by massive perturbers. And I think this is one of the constraints that would need to be taken into account, that the inner galaxy, at least from these data, looks extremely quiescent. And similarly, if you look at the GLIMPSS data, there's hardly any indication of any non-axisymmetric strong spiral structures in the inner disk outside the bar. So both of those, I think, would need to be taken into account. Okay, so now about dynamical models. So these, of course, needed to combine star count and kinematic data. And we decided that even though it's probably not true for bar potentials strictly that they are in equilibrium, they will slowly evolve and maybe also be slightly asymmetric, perhaps. We still need to make some initial go at this assuming equilibrium, dynamical equilibrium. And in this sense, then, we're looking for an orbit distribution in the gravitation potential. So this is what we've been doing. And here, this is a set of data that went into these models. These are between 1 and 3 dimensional data sets, typically the density field, the various radial velocity surveys at the time, and we're also looking at some sort of integrated constraint from the Ogi proper motions in order to constrain the nuclear disk. So the models that we've been using are so-called made-to-measure models. These are particle models that are adaptively trained to approach the data. And it's very simple, and it's also very well suited to galactic astronomy, because we always talk about selection functions. There was a lot of discussion about that last week. So what you actually do is you take a model. In this case, it's a particle model. You observe it, including all your selection functions, just like you think the galaxy was observed. You then compare that to your real data. You see what the discrepancy is. You quantify the discrepancy, and based on that, you change the particle weights, that's, if you like, the masses of the particles in the model. And then you integrate the model forward. You get a new model. You then observe it. And then it should converge. Well, that's a big issue. Should it converge? We don't know. It's known to converge for deviations that are linearly different from the final answer. Of course, we're never linearly different from the final answer. The practical experience that it almost always converge, Curtis, unless you really make a fool of yourself in terms of initial conditions, then it does converge. And especially it does converge when the data are good. All right, so these are some of the some of the data that were fit by, this work was led by a former PhD student, Mathieu Portail. And here, for example, this is the model density on the sky, and this is the sort of mean discrepancy between data and model along the line of sight, and you see it's of the order of a few percent. Then we didn't have a good model for the density of the long bars, so we're fitting the magnitude distributions of the stars indirectly, so these are these data here. You see, this is quite a constraint. These are lots of points and quite small errors. Then some of the data we had allowed us to construct the velocity dispersion as a function of distance, so that was fit. You can see here the distance modulus mu. Sorry, what was that? Distance modulus mu as a function here on the horizontal axis is the streaming velocity. So these wiggles here tell you about the streaming velocity of the field. There was also the Brava survey fitted, that's not shown here, and on the right some data from Apogee at the time, which we didn't fit but predicted, and again you see that this works rather well. So what did we learn? We don't want to just fit the data, there's no point in fitting the data unless you learn something extra. And so what we learned were essentially three things, I think. One is the stellar masses in the inner Milky Way, and that turned out a bit surprising, to me at least. First, it turned out the models wanted very strongly an inner disk that is flatter than exponential away from the bar. Then they constrained the pattern speed to this constraint here, about 39 plus or minus 3.5 kilometers per second, which placed co-rotation around at 6 kiloparsec, which is about a bar R value of 1.2, given the length of the thin bar, about 5 kiloparsec. These models had a stellar mass fraction in the photometric bar and bulge bar and long bar and the inner disk, sort of out to roughly the end of the bar, of about 65%. And this was a number that I had not appreciated before. It means that this part in a region dominates the mass in the Milky Way. It's also true that there is some uncertainty still in this number because of essentially the uncertain inner disk scale lengths outside the bar through the sun and further out. So if you were able to make a very flat outer disk for some reason, then you could add a little more baryonic mass there. So this is this number is for the scale length we think is correct between the sun and the bar, which is about something between 2 and 3 kiloparsecs. The second thing we learned was about the importance of the nuclear disk. And this we could have, we did read before from Launhardt, who based on the COBE data miraculously arrived at a rather good structural model and also on a rather well crafted estimate of the dynamical mass, something like 1.5 times 10 to the 9 solar masses, and that's about 10% of the bulge. That's quite a lot of mass. And it turned out we needed this kind of mass for two separate pieces of kinematic data. On the one hand, we could not otherwise explain the very steep rise of the velocity dispersion profile into the galactic center. And the second point, we otherwise wouldn't be able to explain the high B proper motion seen in the Oglie data at about 3 and 4 degrees latitude. So this structure is shown in the star count here from Nishiyama, and the scale length is I think, order 250 parsecs. But it's a very massive structure, and therefore it's quite important for the dynamics, given its small size. Third thing we learned was about the dark matter profile. The dynamical mass in this region is about the best constraint number based on the models. And then the stellar mass, you know from various considerations, first by counting red clump stars and comparing to the isochrones, then from the IMF, which is constrained by the microlensing. And so the stellar mass is well known within 10%, and the dark matter mass is, you would think, less well known, but it's actually correlated to the total mass, and so it's more less uncertain, let's say, than you would have perhaps expected. And the result of the modeling was, and this is something that we actually confirmed with the new data later, is that if you believe, if you take the density of dark matter in the bulge, which is limited by the total dynamical mass and the stellar mass, it can't be more than about something like 10, 15, 20%. And then you believe the circular velocity curve at this region here, which is between 6 and 8 kiloparsec. We're a bit skeptical about here because of the bar, but this is an essentially flat part of the rotation curve. And then the density from the sun rises so much to about 6 kiloparsec, then it just hasn't got much choice than to bend over to the center. And so then you have to have at least some shallow cusp, but possibly a core. And this is, I think, only an indication. We'll have to see how this goes further. It might actually be lower density than this, but we wouldn't be able to know at the moment. So no NFW in the Milky Way was the result from this. And so after that, now I want to come to my last part of the talk, and this is to do with the new proper motion, both from the Virac data and from calibrated with Gaia. And this is what I'm going to show is mostly based on this paper here, which is headed by a PhD student of mine. And I believe last week or two before, Jason Sanders talked about his work here, which came out in this paper here and the companion, and both of these came out on the same day. It was a very nice and pleasant competition collaboration, if you like. And we did things differently, and we came out with, I think, relatively closely similar results. And you'll see what came out. Okay, so Virac is based on VVV. VVV is a deep infrared survey. And Virac is a near-infrared astrometric catalog that has been constructed from about 10 years of VVV data. And it provided about 300 million relative proper motions in the bulge and the southern disk, which are accurate on the scale of a VVV tile, but are relative. Median error is about 0.67 milliarcsecond per year, that at the distance of the galactic center would be roughly 20 kilometers per second, if I do my estimate correctly. Now, each of these VVV tiles is matched with Gaia DR2 to obtain absolute proper motion by putting everything on the same absolute reference frame. Now, the typical scale, if you do this on a subtile scale, here is a 10 by 10 division, is about 0.1 milliarcsecond per year. That is not very much. This is a few kilometers per second. And we don't know whether this is due to VVV or whether it's due to Gaia. It could be small-scale changes in the reference frame still. It could also be small-scale issues in the VVV survey. But luckily, it's not a big effect. The second thing, which Johnny Clark spent quite a lot of time on, is to subtract the foreground. And we end up doing this with a two-color scheme, which was calibrated on galaxy AMOC models using the previous models. And as you see on the left here, then what's left in the foreground stars here is about this green residual, which we think is about 1% of stars less than 3.5 kiloparsecs away. Now that leaves us with a final sample of roughly 40 million bulge giants, of which we have proper motions, typically accurate, in, if you translate it to kilometers per second, to about 20 kilometers per second. So this is line of sight integrated maps that you see. And so there's a few things one can see. This is integrated over this magnitude range, which is about plus or minus 3 kiloparsecs around the bulge for clump giant stars. You see that clearly the rotation of the bulge. This is this mu L diagram in relative to the solar velocity. You also see the rotation of the bulge in the B proper motion. This is two effects. So here you see if you look at it, it's like a quadrupole, but it's somewhat shifted. It's shifted because of the solar velocity, which is about 7.5 kilometers per second. If you unshift it, you see that this part of the proper motion field indicates what you would expect, is that the bar is coming towards you on the negative velocity side, and it's expanding because it's getting bigger this time. And on the left side, at positive longitude, it's going away from you, and it's getting smaller. So you can see these effects in real time. It turns out, I think, also that there's another effect, and that because a lot of the stars are moving in X1 orbit-like features around the bar like this, those on this side here come closer, and then it's like an airplane moving at you over your head, and of course it sort of goes up in latitude as it does so. So that's the second effect, and we think from preliminary estimate the pattern speed effect dominates, but not by a lot. Then you see in these velocity dispersion maps a very steep inner velocity dispersion cusp. This is due to the deep central potential. And you see the ratio of the velocity dispersions peaking on the disk plane here, where the L dispersion is most prominent, and becoming more equal on the minor axis. And finally, you see that the L and B proper motion dispersions are correlated. This is the second order correlation term, sigma LB. And that is because we think as the orbits come out of the bar and go back in, they also expand in the two perpendicular directions, given the change in surface density. So we wanted to compare this with model, and we used the previous models, and this is shown in the next plot. So what we did is we used models from Mathieu Plotai's work. They were fitted to the star counts and the radial velocities and the nucleus distal disk constraint. We used the Cooper IMF, the mass metallicity distribution function from Zoccoli, the parsec isochrones, and the Virac selection function, including the color selection. And then this is what we think is our currently best model corresponding to those data. And when you look at it carefully, it's absolutely impressive. It's amazing that a model that hasn't been fit to these very complicated data will match these data to do this degree of accuracy. I think it's quoting from a film, it's a hell of an advertisement for dynamical models. It's when you fit enough data to constrain your model, then you can predict other data. This is, I think, what the dynamical model does. Okay, now this model here, actually, I should say, has a pattern speed of 37.5 kilometers per second per kiloparsec. And I think I wanted to, this is the next, this is one that has 50. 50 is not a small number, but it's smaller than the models that are often used to explain solar neighborhood kinematics. And so if I go back and forth, you can see the difference. You can see directly the pattern speed doesn't work. You know? And it doesn't work because these fast bars are too small on the sky. That's this this thing here. And also because they're too small and too far away, they don't have the right structure in the second moments. So that's simply from the integrated maps. We can sort of read off the pattern speed to some degree. There's two other things I wanted to show you. This is the correlation with magnitude. So now you can for each magnitude bin correspond that correlation term in the sigma tensor, normalize it by the dispersion themselves, and you can see here how this correlation from the bright magnitudes goes all the way through the bulge right onto to the other end. Now, our interpretation of this is there's a fundamental correlation that's from the exponential giant branch, because these stars are correlated in the bulge, but they're seen at all magnitudes because it's an exponential luminosity function. That's sort of this and this. And on top of that is the red clump giant stars, which in the bar, in this sort of region, increase the correlations. And the interesting part to us... So it's mu L mu B in expectation divided, but actually we take the mean off, so it's the dispersions, and then we divide by the dispersions sigma L and sigma B.
The diagonal element.
Yeah, that's right. It's a diagonal element, but normalized. So the mean velocities, so mu L minus mean mu L times mu B minus mean mu B, then averaged, and then divide by sigma L and sigma B. Yeah, and okay, and so the reason we think is the red clump giant stars all through the bulge, and notice there's no gap in there at the center. So we can't see any evidence for that there's being some axisymmetric other bulge in there. It all looks like exactly like the model also, in terms of the way this correlation goes through the bulge. So we'd say that it correlates at all magnitudes, and there's no... Oh, no, stop. Okay, good. I'll stop in a moment. Oops. Yeah. Okay. So this is now, I do want to show you this. This is the magnitude resolved maps. So now this is subtracting the giant branch statistically from the total distribution of stars. And so now we're concentrating on clump stars, plus a few other bumps in the luminosity function, which is the red giant branch bump and the AGB bump. And here you can now see the velocity in L varying continuously across the bulge. I'll show you in a moment that this is another measure of the pattern speed, this gradient from the near to the far side. And you can also analyze in some more detail the isocontours in this velocity space. Let's skip this. It's to do with the overall streaming in the bulge, but also the streaming motions that are different from pattern speed. And here on the bottom is the velocity dispersion. Again, you see a very strong peak in the center. And if you look at these plots here, you can also see that the red clump in the X, which is this overdensity in these things, is somewhat colder than the velocity dispersion of the stars nearby. And so both the separation here in mu L, but also the dispersions tell you that these two parts of the red clump are really dynamically distinct. And that should once and for all finish the discussion about them being possibly population effects. Now again, we can compare the data and the model. And this is the same model that we used for the integrated maps. This is again 37 and a half. And you can see it's a bit tricky. You need to take into account that this is bounded here. I don't explain it now, but it's also here, just shaded, and you need to abstract from it and compare the data within the boundary rather than looking at the overall. And again, I can tell you this is now an image which has a faster pattern speed. In this case, I think it's 45. And again, you can see the difference very easily. And you can see very well that the 37.5 is better. And I can I would say that one can see that to a few kilometers per second accuracy, but I wouldn't claim that yet because we're still studying systematic effects. So there are some systematic effects, and we're not finished with this yet. Now, for example, this gradient here is far too strong. Yeah. Okay, I wind up. I want to mention, though, that there is a pattern speed determined by Jason Sanders in this paper here using the Tremaine-Weinberg method, using the same data. And he comes out with a pattern speed determination that's very similar to both the Portai and this our new one. And so we would say that probably we're starting to converge on the pattern speed within 10% or so. And it is Not a slow bar, it's a dynamically fast bar, but it's a large bar. And as such, it will have some effect on the data in the solar neighborhood. So thank you very much. I skipped a few things, but here's the conclusions, so please read for yourself.
Okay, thank you. I'm sure we have some questions. Joss.
It's just remarkable how far we have come. It's remarkable how far we've come with the bar modeling. Fantastic, all the groups are converging as well. The long, thin bar is utterly fascinating. It's so cold and extends further than I thought the bar could extend originally. Mm. So my question to you now is, have such bars been seen in simulations? Have people, I mean, independent of your work, have people ever seen these very long, thin, cold bars? Has anyone actually come forward and said?
There's the only, I haven't looked in simulations in enough detail. There's a question of resolution often, but the only thing I know is it was in one of the galaxy, in one of your Australian colleagues who found a super thin kind of component in an edge-on spiral as well.
Have you observed or modeled?
Observed, yeah. But this is the only analogy I know.
Okay, so in the dynamical models, what spatial region is covered by the models? Is it just the bar or parts of the disk as well?
So we're going out to the sun, typically. And so this is only to do with where you invest your particles, but roughly to the solar radius.
Yeah, but you don't constrain the local kinematics. It's just the constraint. Yeah, the constraints are, dynamical constraints are only for the bar region.
No, we actually fit the rotation curve at the same time. And this is another thing I didn't have time to go into, but what's done is you can, from the current state of the model, determine what the stellar mass density in the bulge is. You know the dynamical mass. You then know the dark matter mass in the bulge. On that model assumptions. You combine that with the rotation curve near the sun. You fit a dark matter model to it. This is parametric. And then you make this parametric model into particles by it's sort of doing the M2M on the dark matter particles as well. And so as you go along, you're matching this dark matter halo at the same time, and you keep the rotation curve to fitting to those pieces that I said.
A short follow-up question. Are you willing to provide the density profile of the models in some easy-to-use form for the community?
Yeah, we've been doing that, and there's still plans to put it all into Galaxia, and we've been using this, in fact, for some of the tests, but they're not, like, ready yet to go public, but otherwise, yes, of course.
Hey, I think you're going to laugh at my question. So way back on slide 9, you had that beautiful measuring the alignment of the bar with the disk.
Yes.
Right. And
slide 9.
Okay. Slide now, 9. I wrote it.
You're better at this than me.
And I was just wondering.
That one.
Any of the deviations from that line? Do you think any of them are real?
So this one.
Yeah.
Oh, it depends on this value Z naught, which we took from the Sloan survey, which perhaps wasn't so bad because it's a larger scale than the OB stars, which tend to give you less. But a long time ago, with James, we had a paper on the COBE data, and there we sort of centered on the maximum in the infrared data, and then it came out 15 kiloparsecs. And if you take 15 kiloparsecs, I think much of this discrepancy goes away.
Yeah, no, parsecs. I didn't.
Yes, parsecs. Yeah.
I didn't actually mean just the whole line. I meant the up and down around the line. Do you think any of that is real?
Ah, the residuals. Oh, that's an order of magnitude harder, so I'm not sure. I wouldn't want to comment. No.
I wanted to ask about the assumptions to triaxiality. So the work that Jason and myself did assumed triaxiality, and I believe the same is also true of your work, because you assume an eightfold symmetry when you deproject.
For the density, yes. So in the bulge. Yeah.
How would any deviations from triaxiality manifest themselves? Do you mm-hmm. see any evidence for any deviations from triaxiality?
So I can show you one thing that we did. This was early on. I hope I have that somewhere here. That's right. So this is the original model for the bar, the bulge. So it was only the bulge. And you see here, these are the density profiles on the three axes. And when we make the model, we assume the triaxiality here for this bulge region, and this is what these lines are. But then we can independently check what's the variation of the points that should be at the same density in the eight corners of the bulge. And that's the error bars here. So they're not very large, except when you get to the end where the data aren't constraining them very well because you're leaving the volume of VVV. So in this sense, from the density in the bulge at least, they cannot be too great. Now, from the dynamical models, we haven't really checked very well whether there's any non-axisymmetries, sorry, non-triaxialities. They're fitted to the density, but only in as much as the weight of the density is. And they are not fitted to any such assumption outside the bulge because there we fit the magnitude distributions directly. But from the argument that presumably the model were already constrained well before the proper motions that we now measure, otherwise they couldn't predict them, it probably means that now they're over-constrained. And so therefore, we'll probably be able to say a lot more about this ultimately. I'm not entirely sure how to do this, but if you have data that over-constrain the model, you must be able to also start seeing deviations from the model, from the assumptions.
I'm just curious that the VARIC data, you said the error bar of the promotion is like 0.6 millisecond per year for your recent work.
Mm-hmm.
So back to the Argos data, it should have a few different components contributed in this bulge error. So I'm just wondering if these halo-like or thick disk-like component contribute to your velocity dispersions. How much of this mm-hmm. do you take into account?
If I understand you correctly, you mean the error in the Virac proper motion.
The error should be quite large compared to the variation of the velocity or velocity dispersion. And then if there are more hot component contaminated in the bar component,
mm-hmm.
how much they contribute to the velocity dispersions and also the velocity dispersion ratio you show in the final slides.
So the error I quoted is not my error. It's given by Lee Smith in the analysis of the VVV data, and it's kind of a typical error. There's a very wide distribution of errors as well. So I was just quoting that number.
Okay.
Then in terms of thick disk-like bars, they're all in the data in as much as they can be seen. And therefore, the dispersion, if you like, is an average over all of these components. And yes, if you were able to distinguish between different components.
For those components, it's not considered in your model, right?
No. In the dynamical model, not. But of course, you can use any combination of subcomponents to do the same analysis, provided you have the data for the same combination in all parts of the model. No, it's like an ordinary genes equation.
Yeah.
No.
Okay, we have time for two more questions. Justin.
Lovely talk, Altwin. So, do you fit for the distance to the galactic center and the solar motion, or are those priors on your analysis, and how sensitive are your results to those numbers?
So, we use standard values. We used 8.2 kiloparsecs for our node, and we used the Schrödinger et al. Solar motion parameters. And which is somewhat more important is the circular velocity near the sun, which we used the Sagittarius A star propulsion result combined with 8.2 kiloparsec. And there, as you may have seen, some of the recent results from Gaia were slightly lower circle velocity than what corresponds to this. And so I think the circle velocity curve is probably the least certain of these.
I mean, it would be interesting to see if you've done it just, you know, if you move those numbers up and down by 10 or 20%, how does that affect, say, the inner dark matter density result, for example? Because that's, you're getting a normalization on the enclosed mass at sort of 8 kiloparsecs from that rotation curve.
Yeah. But I think for R0, I would rather not. I mean, the error from gravity is now, I think, 30 parsecs or so. So that's like minuscule. But on the solar motion, I'm not the expert, but Ralph, what do you think? What's the error that we could use?
Well, there are system mappings by the substructure, so you can go by a few kilometers per second by an hour.
Okay. Yeah. So that shouldn't then make a big difference. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you have another question? Maybe
we have
time for one more. No? Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
It was two now. So you have to decide.
Well, I've already asked a question. So.
Yeah, I thought Ralph wanted.
So just very quickly, classical bulge. How much could there have been before it was spun up by the bar? I mean, I accept your argument that there's nothing that is not rotating, but.
So that's a often misunderstood concept. Is yes, you can spin up the classical bulge from with a bar, but you never get it to the rotation velocities that you see in the boxy bulge.
I agree with that.
No, and so when you look at the Alari in the galactic bulge, then their velocity of rotation is something like 60 kilometers a second or so. This maybe you can do, but not. The 100 and something that you see in the clump stars. So the RLI, however, they have order 1% of the bulge. You know, and my view of this is probably more like a halo bulge component early on rather than a merger made classical bulge. You know, so this is another whole topic we can talk about on the coffee break. But yeah.
Okay, well, let's thank Auckland again.
First, second.